Welcome to the Driving Eureka podcast, where we share ideas and advice for helping you find, filter, and fast track big ideas. Let's go! Hi, I'm Trip Babbitt, advisor to global organizations on the Deming philosophy and host of the Deming Institute podcast.
And I'm Doug Hall, inventor, speaker, teacher, and whiskey maker. I'm also the founder of the Eureka Ranch and author of the Driving Eureka book.
This is the 11th episode of the Driving Eureka podcast. This episode is a discussion of Doug Hall's newsletter, available at DougHall.com, and click under the menu Newsletters. In these segments, we're going to be talking about how to create new ideas in each of the segments. So this is going to be the theme for this entire show. And so, Doug, with that, let's begin. We kind of were talking about what we wanted to do in this episode, and we used stimulus, which we'll talk about here, and the stimulus response system. What is it? And, you know, more importantly, how is it different than the way people currently go about trying to come up with and create new ideas?
Happy New Year, Trip.
Happy New Year to you.
Yeah. So as we start the new year, I thought, what better than to do ideas? And we were texting back and forth, talking about different themes and different things that we were going to do. And suddenly it came to me. I said, what if we just do it live here? And so the classic method of creating ideas called brainstorming, it's usually an event where a group of people get in a room and somebody says, we need ideas. And then they suck the ideas out of their head. And I really call it brain draining because it's just a matter of sucking stuff from our head. What we've learned over the years through lots of experiments with Dr. Van Gundy and others is an approach that we call stimulus response, where we use stimulus to spark ideas. The basic premise is ideas are feats of association. And if we have a piece of stimulus, which can be very simple or random, as we're going to do here, or they can be more sophisticated, whether it's patent mining, wisdom mining, insight mining, market mining, future mining, et cetera. And this like six different types of mining, which we'll get into in time, that can really turbocharge your ability to create ideas. So, you know, when we say, you know, our research has shown there is a system where you can create not just 5% more, 10% more, but Van Gundy's research said 5X or 500% more high quality ideas, based on a paper that we did together. And so in doing this, for this release of the newsletter and the podcast, I challenge you to give me three pieces of unrelated stimulus to create a feature article for this week's newsletter. Okay? And the three things you gave me were?
Dogs, golf, and stock market.
Wow. So awesome. So awesome. I mean, just think about what incredible stimulus that is to create an article. So then I did the obvious thing. I went out and I made up Phillips cranberry mule cocktail, we'll talk about later, because I said, well, I think that now there's no data on this, Trip. There is data on caffeine. Caffeine does increase your creativity. There's no data on cocktails ability, but I'm just going to go with it. Okay. We just don't need to research it. And it feels like it is, although it may not have. Who knows?
Okay.
So the first thing you do with the stimulus is you expand it. Now, if you have a team, you have the team each give you thoughts. If you're doing it individually, you write them down. What comes to mind when you think of? So when you said, texted me dogs, I wrote down loyal, fun, fury, a pack, best friend, trusted, can be nasty, no kill shelters, because my wife volunteers at one of the no kill shelters.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And on golf, this is what I typed. I typed my thoughts were fun, difficult, par, over par, under par, Tiger Woods. I'm sorry. I really love Tiger. I mean, I know he messed up, but at least he's fighting back and, you know, he hasn't given up. And you got to love that. And then lastly, on stock market, this was right at the time of the crazy stock market. You know, scary roller coaster, ups, downs, pressure on CEOs, pressure on those close to retirement. Okay, so now what I've done is I've taken my mind And I've expanded it. I've expanded it into different directions. And as my friend Chick Thompson says, a balloon expanded never goes back to the same shape. Hmm. And it's the same thing with my mind. I've now got my mind thinking about more stuff and there's connections being made. Then I did the obvious thing that one would do at this point. I took another sip of my cranberry mule. Okay.
Is this the requirement? Are we going to have spirits associated with different creativity?
hey, it's the holiday time. Okay. And so I started reading the list over and over again, allowing my brain to make connections. So you're just sort of letting it saturate in the head. It's like you're feeding your mental food processor. And so then I came up with some ideas. And the first one was par, off of par, you know, from golf. Mm-hmm. It made me think of the need to apply benchmarking to innovation speed to market. Companies could compare their projects, people, and processes versus world class. And it could be a system for determining where the blockages are. And so one of the things we could do in the article on the newsletter is we could give people examples of here's the numbers. Like we turned around and we said your meaningful uniqueness needs to be 5s, 6s, or 7s. Well, we could do that with more things because we've got a whole lot of data on it so that they could self-measure themselves.
Ah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that just came from that.
All right.
Okay. Then the next idea was pressure on those close to retirement and no kill shelters. I got to put that to you.
I don't know what that means. It's almost like Soylent. Remember the movie Soylent Green? You remember that thing? Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Okay. Well, never mind. It combines the two, though.
Yeah. So this made me think of a crazy idea. What if big companies, the week before people retire or leave for a company, they go to a no-kill idea shelter? Okay. So because you got all this wisdom that's about to walk out the door. But people are, you know, they don't want to say anything. So they're going to go to the no-kill idea shelter. Mm. And with nothing to lose, they help create ideas for what the company can do with its processes, its products, or its services. Now, think about that. Mm. And think about if we were to go out and we could disguise their voices and we could go interview people who are quitting jobs and say, can you, with your identity disguised, what things which I think we're going to be blown away by the things that people know, but that, you know, passive aggressive or whatever, they're not willing to talk about them.
Hmm. That wouldn't necessarily just have to be people close to retirement.
maybe we should just have a no-kill idea shelter.
I just left the company. I can tell you 50 reasons. I think they call that what's the place Glassdoor that rates companies, you know, where people go out and put anonymous comments about the companies they worked for. And some of them are very nice and some of them are really ugly. So really? Something like that, taking that a step further. Okay, go ahead.
So, and then my last one was roller coaster in Tiger Woods. Okay, so there's a combination. And this made me thinking of companies going back to the notes from previous brainstorming sessions and looking at the ideas generated with some fresh insight. Mm. This could be that some of those that were maybe not good ideas that were down and now have a good potential to make a comeback. And what's interesting about this is that after I typed that in, a day later, I was doing a search on my computer and up came a file of a thing we had done with our partner in Scotland, a session we had done in Rhode Island with them. And I pulled up the deck of stuff and I started reading through it and I realized, oh, my God, there's a wicked cool idea in here that we could tap into that I had not. I just totally forgotten about, didn't realize at the time when we were putting it in, it didn't make sense. But today it offers a cool opportunity. And so I'm going to start to poke at it and see if we can do it. And it involved a different way of making the whiskey, which I can't really talk about, but a whole different approach to making whiskey to create a whole new type of taste. And at the time it was no good, but now that I look at it, I go, geez, there's something cool in there.
Hmm. Interesting. You know, there's one thing that I want to hit upon because this subject to me is another of those things. There was the first thing when I first met you and the Eureka Ranch was this concept of renewing yourself, your company, your team, you know, all of that, that there's more out there. And that really opens your mind. That's kind of infinite universe type of thinking, you know, that kind of blows your mind up. And then there's this second concept of where you really discount the brainstorming session. And I can't remember if it was you or somebody else at the Eureka Ranch that told me that, okay, you know, I told him, I said, I'm struggling with the difference between brainstorming and the stimulus thing, because it was all new to me. And so I had a hard time kind of in my head separating out, okay, what's different? And the explanation that I got was excellent, which was, okay, you're going on vacation and you could either start writing stuff down on a piece of paper about where you want to go on vacation, because Disney World or Europe or, you know, or on a ship or whatever. Or, and then I remember that on the screen, big screen, started with the stimulus, which was, you know, a picture of an ocean, a picture of a beach, a picture of, you
know, top vacation places,
yes,
to go.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden your brain just all of a sudden opens up. I mean, it's really amazing, as opposed to just kind of sitting around with a blank piece of paper, which is really what brainstorming is. Now, I'm sure different people have different operational definitions of what a brainstorming session might look like, but that for me was the difference between the two once I started to actually see it. So it's something that you can communicate, you know, to other people by virtue of actually going out, and even if you don't know what the six different stimulus response pieces are, of just going out and looking on the internet and saying, okay, what are some ideas that they come up with, and you know, plaster them on a, you know, in a Word document or a PowerPoint or something like that, and then show it to your family, and then all of a sudden new ideas will come, as opposed to let's go to Disney World again this year. I think I just don't want to leave this particular segment without saying how huge a difference it is between the what you reference as brain draining versus the stimulus piece. It is literally night and day different as far as the amount.
Yeah, and it is. And it all comes from Alex Osborne. He was the father of brainstorming. And so the proper, I mean, we say brain draining and we get a laugh, and it connects to people because they felt the pain of sitting there in the room saying the same old stuff over and over again. Mm. And so we're building off of his, you know, he had two rules with brainstorming. He coined the phrase brainstorming: defer judgment and quantity breeds quality. And we're in total alignment with that. And I cite him in the book and in our courses, and we show a picture of him and his book Applied Imagination. The challenge is that somewhere along the way, we got messed up on this, that rather than looking at other stuff, some of it was in school. We were taught to not look on other people's papers. And then we got into the corporate world and we had to know everything. Mm. And so it's a sign of weakness to ask others for help or to look something up. I mean, you know. But in today's world, I think it's getting easier and easier as over the years the internet's grown. You know, when we don't know something, we pick up our phone and in three clicks we learn something. Well, it's the same thing, only we're providing systems and structures for it. Whether it's going into the six minings, whether it's SparkDex, whether it's methods for processing it, we've just made it a real science. The team, Maggie, Brad, and the folks at the University of Maine that we work with, Renee and all the rest of them, made a real science of learning how do we increase the effectiveness of this. You know, we're building on Alex Osborne's work. Without Alex Osborne, we're not there. Mm. But we have a tendency in today's world to throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, well, we'll just do something totally different. And it's like, no, Alex had it right. He had it right. It's just we zigged instead of zagged, and society changed. And most recently, so we have these things called SparkDex, these slides, and which is a way to communicate. Everybody goes out and does stimulus mining. They come back and they share it. And one of the things that we've learned recently is that with this new digital age is, and the beauty of it is it's so easy to bring video, audio, and images, and we call them SparkDex 3D, experiential things that we have people do. Mm. And so there is, you know, it's continuing as a science. It's continuing to evolve. It's continuing to grow. But there is a method to the madness. Ideas, you know, it's not about going on the roof of your house and sitting in a lotus position and waiting for lightning to strike. I mean, that's just not the way it is. And, you know, the people we call creative are good at making those connections. Well, you've never been taught, as we said last week. How could you know? Mm. How could you know? There was a way, a systematic way to literally create ideas. People say they can't create ideas. They said, you've never been taught. I guarantee you, you can do it if you learn the step-by-step methodologies that we talk about.
Okay. All right. So is there any other things you want to talk about with regards to creating ideas or brain draining or stimulus response?
Well, let's go right into the book excerpt because it's on the exact same subject.
Okay. It's time now for the Driving Eureka book segment with author and inventor Doug Hall.
It's on the exact same subject, and this is from Driving Eureka, and this is from the Create chapter where I write about this. And I start with a quote from Mark Twain, so, you know, from his biography. And of course, we're talking stimulus response, that's how ideas are created. It's not a sign of weakness that you do that. It's a sign of that you're intelligent. You know, the artist walks in the wood and sees two paths diverge, and Frost writes a poem, you know, about the paths diverging. But Mark Twain had a similar concept. He said, there is no such thing as a new idea. It is impossible. We simply take a lot of old ideas and put them into a sort of mental kaleidoscope. We give them a turn, and they make new and curious combinations. We keep on turning and making new combinations indefinitely. But they are the same old pieces of colored glass that have been in use through all the ages. Written well. I mean, whether it's creating ideas or problem-solving ideas or recreating, and frankly, if you're in the innovation business, you know, the create is 10% of it. 90% of it is in turning the idea and making it real. I was leaving space for you.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's because, I'm still digesting Mark Twain's quote here, you know, and it's funny, as you started to read it, I didn't know where you were going to go. I was thinking in terms of, that was his thought. But so you buy into the concept that there is no such thing as a really new idea. And my brain has always been associating you with there's always a new idea.
So I'm going to correct that a little bit.
Okay, go ahead.
They're all new ideas, but ideas are feats of association. So I'm not going to blame, you know, if somebody had the idea of flying and they tried to flap their wings and it didn't work, then somebody put engines on it and made it work. Well, is that not a new idea? Of course it's a new idea. They figured out how to do it.
Right.
And so it doesn't bother me where they come from. Of course they came from old ideas, and people will sit in teams and say, geez, you know, we've heard these ideas before. I said, are they good ideas? They go, yeah, they're really good ideas. Well, then why didn't you do something about them? Well, they weren't quite right, and now they are right? Yeah. I said, so that's a new idea. Well, no, it's the same idea. Well, get over yourself. You know, I'm just tired of people whining. You know, there's no time for whining. That's my New Year's resolution. No whining accepted anywhere, anywhere. Get over yourself. If you're not making money in your whiskey business, do something about it. Hmm. If you're not happy with your job, do something about it. You know, so much of this is so easy. And so Twain talks about it, but with Van Gundy, we literally did quantitative research. We were working with Frito-Lay. They were willing to work with us, and we created ideas with brain draining and then using stimulus response. And then we sent these ideas we typed them all up and we scrambled them so they didn't know what it is. And Frito-Lay went and they scored which were big ideas, and they had some criteria they had set. How many were big ideas? And literally, there was like 1,100 times, 11x more ideas created with stimulus response, and just under, it's like 5.6 times more big ideas, because they kind of come together. The more ideas you have, the more big ideas you have. I mean, that's like 5x. That's 500+%. Not a little bit. I mean, it's not like this is a tiny thing. This is a step change improvement. A step change would be 100x. This is 500x. 500 times. 500%. It's so easy. It's so easy. But we've got to embrace a world of opening ourselves up to making those connections and you know, accepting that our past thoughts aren't bad thoughts. They may have just been at the wrong time.
So let me ask you this. What, Doug, what are, you know, you read about, let's say, you know, Google, they set aside, I think it was Google that set aside so many hours in a week where they're able to go and you know, think of new products or services, you know, for Google and activities like that. What should companies be doing? I mean, do you really set aside time like that? Is that a necessity, or what's the answer to that?
I've always found that to be just a public relations stunt. You know, giving people time but not giving them the education and the resources and the tools to do it is just frustrating to them. And I've never found – I mean, I worked for Procter & Gamble for a lot of years, and no matter what I was doing, you always have time to think. You just force it. You know, you make it happen, and you can do it. The problem is they don't know what to do. They don't have a purpose. They don't have a mission, you know, which we'll talk about more in future episodes. But, you know, you need to have your innovation project mission. Where are you trying to get to? And we would call it a blue card, but it's, you know, where are you trying to go? And then they don't have a method by which to do it. They've not been taught how to use stimulus response. They've not been taught how to leverage diversity. There are tools and techniques that are available now that can amplify your ability. I mean, we've got ridiculous tools that we've got now that allow you to literally write an idea and the computer reads it and gives you advice on how to make it better. I mean, this is mind-blowing. There is a science to this that people are doing, and there are techniques. But if you've never been taught them, you can sit there forever trying to figure it out, and it's not going to happen.
So
companies need to educate. They need to educate their people.
So and I'm trying to, you know, and I don't want to use this. It's probably overused, you know. But what would perfect look like from an organization from your standpoint? In other words, if I'm an organization, I'm operating the way I am today. What should I aspire to look like from a Doug perspective?
Well, the mission of the Eureka Ranch is to enable innovation by everyone, everywhere, every day. So what you should aspire to is everybody in your organization thinking of ways – let me translate that now – to work smarter – every day. How's that?
That's good. That's good.
Let's look at the opposite. The opposite is, nah, I'm going to do the same old crap, the same stupid way I've always been doing it. And you know what the hell? It's a stupid company and it's not my money. That's why we have 30% employee engagement.
Right. Right. Yeah. There's a lot of things associated with that, but certainly one of them is aspiring to be part of something that's has some usefulness, in society, and being able to use your brain in such a way that I'm looking forward to the new thing that's coming, that I can participate in that.
There's a simple term for that. I think it's called leadership. You know, it's a leader inspires the troops to charge the Bastille. The leader inspires the troops to create this startup company. The leader inspires the team to do this because they paint a vision of what they need to do and how it's going to make a difference in the world. It's called leadership, not management. It's a trite thing, but that's as simple as that. We have leaders and we have managers. We need more leadership in the world. at all levels of the organization, by the way. So don't be just picking up the nuts at the top. Everybody has a sphere of influence. So you need to start. The only way this starts, Dr. Deming's daughter told me, you have to change the person before you can change the organization. So no more whining. Remember, that's the new mission. No whining. Where can you lead? What yours in your sphere of influence? How can you make a difference? That's what our new fundamentals course is all about. And if you're getting this, there's probably a link to the online fundamentals course that you can go through that I just redid all of the course, all of the videos to teach this for people. You have a sphere of influence. Let's get started right now. And then with that, it'll start to grow.
Okay. All right. Yeah, this leads to a lot of questions. Some of these are themes that we have discussed before. So, for instance, one of the themes, and I just want to touch upon it because it's such a reality, which is we're so busy with the schedules and the things that we have just to get the daily activities done in a day. When am I going to have time to do this? That seems to be the tug, which is, geez, that would be great if we could do all that. But man, my day's full, and that's just taking care of my current customers.
Okay,
and doing
these things. I got an idea.
Okay,
I got an idea.
Okay,
how about if we use the stuff we're talking about to invent a way to work smarter on what you have to do now? Nothing new. Just do your current work smarter. Find a more efficient way to do it, a more effective way to do it. Change the system of how you get your work done. Start with your existing project list. Let's work those smarter. That's what we're teaching people to do.
Okay, but then I go back to some of the earlier conversations that we had where you talked about, you got to spend some of your time in, creating new things, or you're going to be left in the dust. So even
I understand, but okay. Let's walk before we run.
Okay? All right,
let's not start with the Boston Marathon.
Okay.
All right. Let's get wins and get our courage up. And let's build ourselves space because we've worked on ways to more efficiently do the stuff that we've got there. And keeping a sense of urgency that we do need those leap ideas. We need those transformational ideas.
Okay, so let me ask this, which is, let's say I'm a new CEO in a company, and I know that things are changing in the universe and in the marketplace, and it doesn't really matter what business it is, but I recognize that I need to do a leap in this new organization I just took over. But my people are back just trying to get the daily washout. Are you going to slowly and incrementally go through and kind of bring their people along and ignore the leap for a period of time, or do you kind of find a way to do both?
Okay, so if you're a leader, that's different. If we don't have the leadership, then it's your sphere of influence and you start there and get started.
Okay.
If we have the leader, what my advice to the leader is very simple. Let's ask for volunteers to run an experiment in a new way of accelerating leap innovations. And because within an organization, there's the diffusion of innovations curve. There's about 15% that are innovators and early adopters within any organization, about 15%. And the math is solid. And when you ask for volunteers, there'll be a group of people that'll volunteer. And you put a team together, get yourself a coach to help with it, or read the books, take the classes online. I don't care how you do it. And the leader has to be involved. You can't outsource this. And the leader helps set the strategic mission, the blue card, working with the team, and go on this adventure journey together. And in about 3 months, you're going to see a magical transformation start to happen, is because people will start to believe they can win again. Because your people can do this. I know they can. I'm yet to find idiots working at companies. I found some smart people. But as a general rule, the people are there. Deming would always say, well, if you fire all the people, what makes you believe that the next ones are going to be any different than the ones you got now? They won't. You got to change the system. So for a leader, my mission to you is pick some volunteers, get going, accelerate the process, I mean, we even offer Eureka Inventing, which makes it go even faster, so to guarantee results quickly. But just get started. And then with that success, you can then start to build the others.
Okay.
But you got to do it, and you got to do it quickly because, you know, if it's going to take you 3 months, 3 months from now, that means it's 6 months away. And 9 months from now means it's a year away. So what's slowing you down? Let's go.
This is the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy podcast, where we will take you behind the scenes so you can see what it takes to build a whiskey distillery business. The Eureka Ranch team, led by Doug Hall, are creating a craft whiskey company with patented technology like has never been done before. Let's move to the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy. And how are, since we're on this theme, Doug, of creating ideas, how did this play out, or how does this play out in your whiskey distillery?
Okay, so what I want to do is I want to talk to you about how new whiskeys are created. And because I've had the good fortune to work with some brilliant people in this field. But I have to start by explaining the difference between making beer and making whiskey. When you make beer, the brewer is the whole thing because they – the grains and how they set it together and the fermentation and what they do, and they craft the beer. And the beer is the beer. It comes out. You drink it. When you make whiskey, the distilleries are usually run primarily by a computer, and it is what it is. And what you get out is this pretty white, clear spirit that doesn't have much flavor in it. I mean, it makes a difference if what grain it is, but fundamentally, they're all, unless you do it badly, a bourbon is a bourbon, a rye is a rye. You can do them badly. There's not a lot of headspace to do them greatly. They are what they are. Usually it's because people fall. The magic happens in the wood. That's where 70% of the flavor comes in, the wood. But the wood is so variable that when you put your whiskey in barrels, and some are at the top where it's warmer in a warehouse, some are down below, some are on the side, some are inside, there's different types of woods that you're using. That's where the magic happens. And so while the brewer is the magic for beer, the whiskey maker, who's the person who takes these barrels and puts them together, is the real magician who makes the magical things happen. So you follow me?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. So I had an opportunity, one of the most epic moments that I have had over the last 25 or so years working with the major spirits companies was I was at the Macallan Distillery, who I've worked with. I've worked with Macallan for now over 20 years, with Bob DiGiano, who's retired now. And he had created a whiskey for the Diamond Jubilee of Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. This was back in 2012.
Yep.
Her 60th anniversary to becoming the queen. Okay. And this whiskey had been made, and it had sold out rapidly, and it was getting rave reviews. And we're sitting there in his place where he makes the whiskey, where he mixes them, and he's got bottles of all kinds of barrels and that kind of stuff. And he said, "Have you tasted the Jubilee?" And I said, "No, I haven't. It's sold out." "Oh," he says, "I'll make you one." I said, "What?" And he goes over and he takes a pipette and he takes a sample from one barrel and then another sample from another barrel and another barrel. And he puts them together and he serves them up and he says, "Here, try that." And as I was before I even drank it, I said, "Well, what are you trying to do with this?" And he starts to tell this incredible story, as he says, it's the spring. The new queen is the new queen is there, and it's a bright day, and there's such hopes for the young lady who's taking over. And he goes through this wonderful, wonderful story. And you sit, and then you tasted it, and you could literally, he says, "That's what I put in here." So what he'd done is he had created a thought piece in his head of the moment he was trying to create for people. Ah. And that was his stimulus that inspired. So rather than just try to say, "Let me make something taste good," he had a story that he was trying to match it to. And it was magical. I mean, it just had it. There was a lightness, but a significance to the taste, if that makes any sense. And I mean, they're just spirits, but the power of that story, of that stimulus, was the same. And you know, since I've created Brain Brew, we do the exact same thing. So, I mean, it was sitting with Bob, it was just, it blew my mind that somebody could literally create a vision and then match the tastes to make that moment come to life.
And so that's in essence, you know, as I hear this, and I'm going to just restate what you just said to some degree, but is this concept of the story, that there is, whether it's a drink, there's that you made, basically, you know, from scratch or, you know, something new that's out there, and the story associated with what's driving the production of something.
The concept.
Yeah.
You know, there's a synergy between the marketing and the moment and the product. Hmm. They're a system that works together.
That creates the story, in essence. Okay. All right. I'm following that.
And it creates the whole thing so that it's a whole – it's not just, let me get you technically the best tasting whiskey in the world. There's many whiskeys. But this makes that moment come to life. And so now you're seeing a sense of crafting. And that's part of the reason why he's got it in all of his products. That's part of the reason why Macallan's the most expensive whiskey in the world. It's one of the most successful. It's grown 1,600% over the last 20 years. Is because there is that level of craftsmanship, even in a big company, an intense craftsmanship that's going on with folks like Bob and now the others that lead it.
You know, it's funny that you say that, and, you know, you're probably going to laugh. My family does regularly. There is a drink at the Polynesian Resort at Disney World, and it's called the Lapu Lapu. I don't know if you've had it, Doug, or not, but it's in a pineapple. And I'm not sure everything that's in it. I know rum's in it and pineapple, obviously. But I love the Lapu Lapu, and you're only allowed to have two. If that gives you any idea, right? So I always go to the Polynesian and I order this Lapu Lapu. Well, interesting enough, I started to get curious about what the hell is a Lapu Lapu? You know, what is a Lapu? So I went back, and, you know, of course the internet's available to you, and I looked up Lapu Lapu. Well, there was a king, Lapu Lapu, in the Philippines, on one of the islands. And he is the one responsible for killing Magellan. So that was the story. And so every time, this last time that we went, we always go for the Food and Wine Festival in the fall. And, you know, one of the big things that we like to do is obviously go over to the Polynesian. We have this, and I'll not forget this. And hopefully someday these girls will listen. And my daughter is about their age, about 20, 21 years old. Well, they had to be 21 because they were drinking. But they, you know, they said, hey, do you have a drink that you would suggest here? My wife, you could see her roll her eyes. You've asked the wrong guy, you know, type. So I went on to tell them, oh yeah, you got to have the Lapu Lapu. And here's the story. And I told the story and everything. And these girls got a huge kick out of it. But see,
the neat thing is, so there's an integrity, there's a story, there's a drink, there's a connection.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think
so these are not, you know, what I hate is sometimes, you know, you get this marketing story and you get the product and the two are not connected.
Right.
And you're like, what the hell is this? You know, that doesn't make any sense. But they've just like thrown it at the wall because one department did one thing and one did the other. The key is to get, when you're crafting a spirit, is to make it come together, which is what you've got there at Disney. It's all coming together as one.
Right. Yeah, no, it's something, you know, very, very unique. So how have you applied this then, the story to your whiskey distillery?
So at Brain Brew, of course, we make custom whiskey. So we say, you know, everybody deserves their own whiskey. And so, but we have some examples of ones that we do that are our whiskeys, but we encourage people to come in and they go through a tasting experience and they craft their own whiskey with their story and their thing. And that's what we encourage them to do. We teach people how to do this. You can come and you can literally come to our distillery at the Eureka Ranch on Saturday night and we will teach you and you'll go through the process tasting 12 different whiskeys, wheat, corn, rye, and barley, Old World, New World, and craft, and you'll make your own. But one of the ways we do this is we show our story to it. And it's not Bob's story of the Queen, but it's our story of Cincinnati, which, as I mentioned, was the, you know, the king of whiskey. This is where all the whiskey came out of Cincinnati mm-hmm. when it got on the riverboats. And so we've created a riverboat series honoring Cincinnati and its role in the history of American whiskey and created different products. And so we've got them in there named Keelboat and Paddle Wheel and Tall Stacks and et cetera off different boats. But for our paddle wheel, we really wanted to do something magical. We wanted to really create, how could we go back to the time before Prohibition, which is when, because Prohibition caused all of this to blow up. But before Prohibition, that pre-Prohibition time, could we take people back to what whiskey would have been like back then? And in this case here, what we did is, and this is nuts, but this is going even further, is I've been very blessed, incredibly blessed, to be able to taste a lot of whiskey over the years, having worked with Macallan and others for many years. And one of the things I've gotten to taste is a lot of very old whiskey. I was at Ken Greer's house once, and I had 1920, 1930. I mean, whiskeys from way back in time, okay? And over in Scotland at his house. And when you taste those old whiskeys, there's a very unique character to it. There's a I'm going to say darkness, and I don't mean darkness in a bad way. Hmm. It's like a depth to it that you get when you taste them. And so I said, how could I recreate that taste, which would have been whiskey back at the time of the riverboats, you know, approximately. Ah. And sure enough, what we found is somebody said, well, what about the wood? If 70% of the flavor comes from the wood, what if we used old wood? I said, well, you know, there aren't any old barrels that old. They go, no. I know where there's a barn that fell down. And that barn, the wood there is probably 200 years old. It was probably 100 years when they cut the trees, and it's been there over 100, maybe 150 years. So it could be 250 years since the trees grew. But conservatively, call it 200-year wood. That would have been the wood they would have used to make barrels. Mm. I said, huh, that's pretty cool. And so we turned around. We got some of the wood. We cut off the outside. We ran chemical tests. And amazingly, what we found was that wood is cleaner than the wood from trees today because there's less pollutants in the air. It was actually cleaner wood than the wood today, which is – now, the wood today is fine, but there was – I mean, it was just a very clean wood. So this was virgin American wood. And we cut it into pieces. We char it, and we put it into the time compression machine that we have here, which mimics seasons of aging. And sure enough – the taste blows you away. It is that same taste I'd had at Ken Greer's house, which is that very old. And I had one of the guys who's one of the big auction houses, or it sets the prices. And we sat with him in Edinburgh, and I gave him a taste. I said, hey, try this, see what you think. And he says, okay, now I'm really mad at you. And I go, what's the matter? He says, well, your whiskeys have always been okay. But now you're replicating very old, very, very expensive whiskey. Is there no end to what you're going to do? Well, I said, well, of course there's no end to it. I'm going to keep doing. He says, that is truly amazing. That finish, that is truly amazing. And so here what we've done is we're literally – so when you come to the bar at the Eureka Ranch and you come in and you ask one, I'll just say, I'd like to take you back to the time of the riverboats when Cincinnati was the queen city of the West, when all the whiskey, 70 distilleries in town, and if you'd have ordered – an upper deck whiskey, one of the finest whiskeys. This is paddle wheel is the taste that you would have had back then. And you can notice the depth and the richness of the taste as this bourbon, which they weren't called bourbons at the time, but they were using high amounts of corn. Bourbon didn't come into vogue until later. I believe I've got my timing right. I think it came a little later. But it was the same type of grain. This is the kind of ultra premium spirit that you would have had. And it's no difference in what Bob did talking about the young queen.
Interesting. That's a great story. Let me you did say something in there that really got my brain wrapped around this. You know, you're talking about the pollutants in the wood that exist today that weren't there before. Is that something that you can chemically actually remove, the pollutants, or is that?
I don't know that you can remove them, okay, but you can measure them.
Yeah,
because if you remove them, you're probably going to remove and we're talking trace levels. I mean, we're not talking anything that's even close to a safety issue.
Okay.
But you can see traces in it that you can't see in the older wood. It was different. And the trees grew closer together. They weren't on tree farms, and so the rings are much denser. I mean, it's just visually, I mean, it's just different wood. But if you removed them, you'd also remove the good lignans and the things that give us all the flavor that goes into the whiskey, which comes from the wood.
So is part of the key to a good whiskey then finding, I don't know, wood that's not polluted? I mean, is that part of your...
Well, I wouldn't say polluted so much as really great wood. You know, we're very firm. We've run some experiments. We've got some more going on. There's the, when the bourbon boom happened, sadly, a whole lot of companies, they used to air dry the wood. You'd leave it out for a couple of years to air dry it, to get the water down, and then you'd finish it up and make the barrel. Everybody moved to kiln dried wood. And sadly, most distillers don't even know if they're getting, well, they're getting kiln dried. I know they are because the air dried is so much more expensive. And one of the key secrets to our success is that we can use air dried wood. And because of the way we do it, and we're so much more efficient, that we can give you back the taste that you used to get in rye or bourbon or whiskey, whatever form you're making. Because kiln dried is literally dead wood. And we've got more experiments to run on it, but we only use air dried wood in our whiskey. And it's expensive. And, you know, you got a lot of people who can't even afford the barrels. The barrels can get ridiculous. And so instead they're using used barrels, which are basically dead barrels. I mean, that's what they use in Scotland, but they leave it for a long time. And they're using barley, which is just a whole different animal. And so the wood is the whole thing. The whole thing is the wood. And then putting that whiskey together by mixing and matching. But if you've only made 30 barrels, you got no chance. So with our technology, not only can we use oak, which is the, you know, the classic, but we use maple and we use chestnut and we use cherry and we use old ones and new ones and, you know, there's all kinds of woods that you can use, and they all create different tastes. And some people are finishing it with different ones. We just happen to do it very, very quickly and very, very high precision.
That's interesting. So this is how Create really gets into the whiskey business then, is just experimenting with these different woods, which you say is makes up 70% of the taste. So that's an incredible story. I like the idea of the story behind the whiskey, and as that develops, I'm curious to see how this goes on, especially with your riverboat, you know, story that you've started. This is like a journey.
Yeah, and interestingly, it goes both ways. Okay, so in this case here, the story came and then the product came. But yeah, successful whiskeys are a system of interconnected parts where the parts all work together. The price, the package, the product, the positioning.
Got it.
We've also got a line that started from and this is crass, but it started from, okay, our Riverboat line sells for $35 for a 750 ml bottle, classic size bottle. We wanted to come up with a luxury edition that would be, we haven't set the price yet, but it would be in the $60, $75 range. Okay, now our $35 drinks like a $60, and our $60 should drink like $120. That's what we try to do. Okay. As a craft guy, we want to have more value for the money. I mean, even at $60. And so I started with challenging the team to say, okay, how do we make a $120 tasting whiskey? And there was no story to it. And we started and started and started to play, and we started to play with technologies and started to work with different things and get more precise on different things and different woods and different combinations of woods. In this case, taking oak from different countries and different places and really taking the science in deeper until And so we would drink the $35 version, and then we would taste the next one and say, does that seem like a wow? And there was beating ourselves. We're playing King of the Hill with ourselves. Okay, there was no story. It was just called, as a business, we need to get this product. Now, let's see if we can get a product. Then we got the product, and the product is now inspiring the story.
Yes.
So we're doing it in the reverse direction as we're doing this. And we haven't settled on it yet, so I don't want to say it yet, but there's some really cool elegance coming to this, and another story's developed that is an authentic story about what we're doing combined with this amazing product that the team have made. And so you can start from price. You can start from a package. You can start from a bottle. Our Relativity product, if you look at relativitywhiskey.com, you go see it. It's in a Erlenmeyer flask type looking thing. I mean, the package inspired the Relativity brand. Okay. And so you can start from anywhere. The key is that serves as stimulus to help you create the rest of the story.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a whole, you got this is stimulus mining at its best. You got a whole series of things running through my brain about how the stories develop. It could be the product first, but also it could be the story of the wood from Germany and the wood from Australia. And you've got the bride and the groom and the woods come together. You know, my brain just starts going off on
yeah,
as you start to put together things like that.
Or for Arts Wave in Cincinnati. Cincinnati Music Hall, famous grand music venues, symphony and pops. We're working with ArtsWave, the nonprofit that raises money for the arts in Cincinnati. And we have, when they renovated Music Hall, there was a bunch of wood around the organ when it was rebuilt. And so we've got those beams and we're about to craft a whiskey that would be, it's going to be one of those very old style whiskeys of the history of music hall and the arts. And so, you know, it's just writing itself, the music, the theme, the elegance to it. I mean, it's just writing. It's going to be classical and it's just going to be magnificent whiskey. I by the time we're done, it's a lot of craftsmanship to build it. There's a lot of craftsmanship to build these things and do them right. And the sad thing is most craft people, you know, you go like hell and you don't have the time to do this thinking, but it's this thinking that's going to make the difference for you over the long term.
Okay.
I mean, short term, everybody will buy your stuff because you're local.
All right.
If you really want to create something significant in this business, having, you know, this is the voice of experience from a long, long time. You try something quickie and it never seems to work. It's gimmicky. But you got to have that depth and authenticity to really make it work.
Interesting. Very good. Well, let's move on to your craft cocktail recipe, which the Cranberry Mule is now going to be known as the Create drink. Because it's associated with what you had when you did the story. So now it's got a story.
So this the concept here of this cocktail, the concept of this cocktail was it is Christmas morning. And this is going to be just a very think of gingerbread and elves and magical, mystical. Whether it's Christmas morning or Christmas Eve, it's really evoking the spirit of, with a sense of whimsy to it, and bringing that to life. And so we're bringing together the flavors of ginger and cranberry and some gin for the spice to it, and just giving you this unique, a little bit of orange zest, and giving you this sense of that holiday, so that if Santa was going to have one, this is what Santa would have had. Okay.
Okay.
That's what we're talking. And so it plays off the mule, a classic drink that uses ginger beer, but Philip created this one as well. It's called the Cranberry Mule, and the recipe is in the notes. So if you're driving, you don't have to write it down. You can look it up or just go to the newsletter. It's in the newsletter at DougHall.com. It's an ounce and a half of gin, 1.5 tablespoons of cranberry syrup, and the cranberry syrup, the recipe's there. You take some fresh cranberries, water, sugar, ginger, and some orange zest. You kind of cook them together to make this basically cranberry simple syrup. So 1.5 ounces of gin, 1.5 tablespoons of cranberry syrup, 4 dashes of cranberry bitters. Top it with some ginger beer and an orange garnish. And so that's what we're talking. Just a wonderful, I mean, it's just going to take you to Christmas Eve or Christmas morning after the presents. You're just sitting and chilling and you're just having this thing as an aperitif before you have the turkey and the cranberry sauce and the whole the rest of it.
Okay. All right. And so does it have a strong cranberry taste then? Is that kind of the overriding taste of it?
So when you make a cocktail, we really try to create what's called an accord, a balance, a tension. Mm-hmm. So what you've got is you've got the gin, the cranberry, and the ginger, and the orange sort of in an accord that kind of comes together. So you've got elements of them, but the sum of the parts is greater than the individual pieces.
Ah, okay. They play well together.
They do. That's what you're trying to do with a cocktail, is to take these pieces and come make them into something magical. And this one is magical.
Very good. All right. Well, this concludes the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy and talking about how to create in the whiskey space.
And this episode, as I'm thinking about it, if you're creating a craft distillery, you got to listen to this episode, man, because this is the real deal. This is how it really happens. The epic, the huge ones around the world. I've been in the rooms with the people. This is how it really creates. And it's, I mean, we're just selling ethanol, okay? And it just happens to be uniquely flavored because it's a magical wood. But you got to get into it. And that's why I love the craft business, because the craft business, as opposed to just a straight commercial business, there is a love and a care. And big companies, some have it, some don't. Macallan is one that has it a lot. I mean, that's the success. That's why they're successful. Other companies don't. And craft companies that win, that's what they have, whether it's craft whiskey or whatever your business might be.
Very good. All right. Well, this has been an interesting episode. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you, Tripp.
Because we appreciate you as a listener, we are offering for a limited time 4 things. A 1 hour abridged audio of the Driving Eureka book. A subscription to the Driving Eureka newsletter, which contains weekly advice from Doug Hall on how to find, filter, and fast track big ideas. And the newsletter has other offers that are not made public. The Driving Eureka prescription for success. You answer questions and we'll help you assess your ability to find, filter, and fast track big ideas. And you get advice on how to grow your ability to innovate. And the last item, access to a Doug Hall interview with a radio legend. To get these offers, go to www.doughall.com/podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to the Driving Eureka podcast on iTunes.